This is CGSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University. We respectfully acknowledge that we broadcast on unceded ancestral territory of the Coast Salish peoples. We stream online at cjsf.ca. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and listen to our podcasts on SoundCloud and our website, cjsf.ca. Have a request? Text or call us at 778-782-2573.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, terrorist atrocities in Israel, Israeli atrocities in return, seeds sown, reaped, then sown again.
Hamas bears no small fault of blame or responsibility with respect to this. But Hamas wouldn't have been created except for the conditions that the Palestinians wind up living in. The collective punishment that Israel has imposed upon Gaza, particularly in the last 16 to 17 years with the blockade, is a fundamental violation of international humanitarian law.
Israel, Palestine, Russia, Ukraine, the U.S. versus Russia and China. What sense to be made?
A lot of the clamor and tumult you are listening to is the contradictions of capitalism just essentially entering their last throes. These are very, of course, dangerous times for precisely that reason. The West does not wish to accept this. So what you're hearing is a denial. You know, it's like the old man putting on dark hair dye and trying to look young. I mean, it's not going to work.
Before descending into the horror, help us deliver this weekly package of Earth News. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. In preparation for imminent Israeli ground invasion, thousands of Gazans are now fleeing the northern half of the tiny enclave, already devastated by 16 years of brutal siege. In response to last week's horrific assault on Israeli communities east of its Gaza ghetto, the Israeli military ordered Gaza's 1.1 million northern residents to get out. Almost a half million are now trying to do so. 1,300 Israelis perished in last week's horrific terrorist attack, mostly civilians, and 150 were taken hostage. 300 soldiers were killed. According to Gaza's health ministry, over 2,300 Gazans have been killed by Israeli bombs, including 700 children. 70 died in an airstrike on Friday, including children, in the course of fleeing. 10,000 have been wounded. In a news release this past Friday, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Internally Displaced Persons declared that Israel's evacuation order, after cutting off food, water, electricity, and fuel to Gaza, then dropping 6,000 bombs, some of them reportedly white phosphorus munitions, constitutes forcible transfer and collective punishment, crimes against humanity under international law. Forcible transfer and collective punishment are nothing new for Gazans. Three-quarters of the enclave's 2.3 million residents are already refugees or the descendants of refugees driven from their villages by Zionist militias in 1948. The lovely Israeli communities, brutally invaded by Palestinian militants last weekend, lie on or near the ruins of those Palestinian villages, an irony mainstream media has ignored. The GPM spoke about the unfolding situation in Gaza and Israel with Michael Link. Link is Associate Professor of Law at Western University in London, Ontario. Between 2016 and 2022, Link served as UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967. Hello, Michael Link. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
David, thank you very much for having me. Always a pleasure.
These are very depressing times. There's no moral or ethical clarity. There's vast volumes of confusion and ignorance about history And it's hard to make sense of this awful act of violence that these militants committed in the course of those hours in southern Israel. But now Israel is unleashing vast, vast, colossal violence on Gaza. What sense do you make of all this?
Well, David, we can think of this in two different levels. The first, obviously, is the visceral and the immediate. And what happened in Israel on Saturday with the death of what now appears to be around 1,200 Israelis, the large number of whom are civilians, and the kidnapping and hostage-taking of perhaps 50 to 100 back into Gaza is abhorrent. It's a violation of every norm of international law. It's a violation of all of our norms of morality. So I think we have to say that and say that unequivocally. What has been happening in retaliation or revenge, and what is likely to be much more massive in the weeks to come, is going to be immense bloodshedding in Gaza, largely by innocent Palestinian civilians. International law does not recognize an eye for an eye. That leads us to the land of the blind, as Gandhi would say. So on the visceral level, I think we all have a feeling of being appalled, shocked, dismayed. My term is gutted with respect to what's happened. As someone who's followed this for several decades, it is, you know, at a political level, and I when I say this term, I don't mean to diminish the immense loss of life. But for the Palestinians, at least for the foreseeable future, it's what would be called an own goal in soccer. I mean, this puts back the work of those who believe in justice and peace and a compassionate resolution in Israel-Palestine a long ways. It makes it harder to explain that this and provide the proper context to it with respect to this is a relationship between an occupier and an occupied. And as a lawyer, if I can say on a broader level, you know, there are distinct rules of international law that no matter how just the cause is, there are things that the law does not permit you to wind up doing. The use of mass indiscriminate violence against civilians cannot be justified under law, even if the Palestinians have a right to resist, which they do have a right to resist under international law.
Do they have the right to resist with violence?
They have the right to resist with violence, even. But that would have to be directed towards soldiers and occupying military force. It would have to be directed towards military bases. It would have to be directed towards anything that constituted a military component of the occupation. But we also have to realize that the Palestinians are extremely outgunned, if you like. The military might that Israel has is far and superior to what the Palestinians could wind up mustering. And I've said for a long time, there are many Palestinians who will say the same, is that by far the best strategic, political, and moral path to follow is to develop a campaign of political nonviolence. That is the way in which you win public opinion. That is the way in which you show, if you like, the brutality of the occupation. An Israeli general several years ago admitted, we don't do Gandhi very well. You wind up exposing the weak parts of an occupation that is now the longest occupation in the modern world. So those would be the paths that I think are probably politically wise, morally wise, diplomatically wise, and it takes advantage of the energy of civil society. I lived in Jerusalem and Bethlehem in 1989 at the height of the first Palestinian Intifada. I was working for the United Nations doing human rights and refugee work, and I saw the power of nonviolent and resistance, of civil disobedience, and it produced significant gains for the Palestinians. I think a continuation, a widening of that would have been the best way to wind up proceeding. But I also understand, and look, I've spent my 6 years when I was the UN Special Rapporteur preaching and preaching again with respect to the absolute indispensability of the international community and of Israel and of the Palestinians following international law, the rules of international humanitarian law, human rights law, criminal law, with respect to this, to little avail. You know, Israel has lived on the other side of the red line with respect to international law for almost all of its occupation, and it only winds up getting worse in terms of its violations of the Fourth Geneva Convention, the whole body of human rights treaties, of international criminal law, and the Rome Statute. And when the Palestinians see that the world is not coming to their rescue with respect to international law and the many defiances by Israel of UN Security Council resolutions and UN General Assembly resolutions, then it gives credence to those who say, why pay attention to international law? Why pursue nonviolence? Why follow diplomacy when the enemy won't listen and the world won't come to rescue us? International law to work also requires international resolve. When you have both international law and international resolve put together, you have a situation where the rules of the world are likely going to wind up working.
Michael Link, I want to ask you, no one can justify or condone, much less support what these Hamas militants did, but one can certainly try to understand why they did what they did. Can you tell me what the situation is in Gaza? You've written, when you were a special rapporteur, you devoted a lot of your time and effort investigating and reporting on the situation in Gaza. Could you sum up for us what the situation is in Gaza and has been for the last certainly 16 years since the start of Israel's siege that would drive people like Hamas militants to do what they did?
Sure. Look, and I think you said it right. What I'm going to be telling you is about the conditions in Gaza. This helps to explain or even to understand what we saw over the last 4 days. It doesn't justify it. So I say that in this particular context. Many international observers have said that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory is brutal. And Gaza is at the sharp end of this brutal stick. Gaza is made up of over 2.3 million people, Palestinians, living in a walled-off enclave on the shores of the Mediterranean, where they are completely blockaded, where Israel has since 2006 conducted a comprehensive air, sea, and land blockade that nothing gets in and nobody gets in and nothing gets out and nobody gets out except with Israeli permission. And Israel allows just enough supplies of water, power, food, diesel, and goods to enter into Gaza to keep that, their head above water, but not to let them reach any kind of island of autonomy or self-determination. So what we have in Gaza is a humanitarian crisis that's been going on for decades now. Keep in mind, of the 2.3 million Palestinians who live in Gaza, 67% of them are refugees or descendants of refugees. Almost 50%, I think it's probably right now the figure is 47% of the population of Gaza is 18 years or under. So it's a very young population that's never known anything except the very tight quarters that they wind up living in.
Refugees from where?
Refugees from areas in what is now the Israeli south, from along the coast between Gaza and Tel Aviv. There were a number in 1948, a number of Palestinian villages, towns, and communities as well. Deeper inland in the Israeli Negev were very large Palestinian populations. They were driven out in 1948, 1949 by Israel during the creation of the State of Israel, and they wound up in refugee camps. And from that area, some in the southern West Bank, many of them in Gaza, penniless, impoverished, and with only the assistance coming through the United Nations. What we have today is a collapsing healthcare system for the 2.3 million Palestinians who are there. They have a very inadequate third world healthcare system with inadequate staff, difficulties in obtaining medical equipment for treatment beyond primary care, because Israel blocks shipments of medical equipment coming into Gaza, as well as real shortages of pharmaceuticals to be able to treat the population. So when you have an emergency health crisis that is going on now, you have the hospitals overwhelmed with the badly injured who are, and the hospitals are already trying to cope with the ordinary flow of Gazans who need medical attention. You have sanitation issues where there's a lack of fuel to be able to power the sanitation facilities to be able to treat the waste that's generated in Gaza. So much of the waste winds up going in unfiltered into the Mediterranean Sea, which creates obviously the danger of serious health problems and the spread of communicable diseases. Water is one of the most serious issues in the Gaza Strip. Gaza sits on a coastal aquifer, which is 97% contaminated, undrinkable, because of the seepage of seawater and of sewage into there. So potable water is produced either by water that comes in from Israel, which the Gazans have to buy, or through desalination plants, which only run with fuel. And the desalination plant only works for, supplies water for about 30% of the population. You have large amounts of food which enter into Gaza. They do have some farming areas, but right now with the destructions that are going on, we're having issues with the ability of those who have chicken farms or livestock farms. They're liable to collapse because they don't have the fodder, which is imported, to be able to feed the chicken and the livestock, which place not only the livelihood of these herders and farmers at risk, it just means the ability to be able to supply food for the population in Gaza, such as eggs or yogurt or cheese or protein or meat, is all going to be at risk within the next several days with this total blockade that Israel has imposed since Saturday.
And of course, Israel says, we weep for the poor Gazans, but this is all Hamas's fault. And of course, this is the same, the United States and Canada and the European Union, they all say the same thing. It really is all Hamas's fault. Then Israel has the right to sustain this blockade because it's threatened by Hamas, these wild, crazy terrorists.
Well, the answers to that are several. Look, Hamas bears no small fault of blame or responsibility with respect to this. But Hamas wouldn't have been created except for the conditions that the Palestinians wind up living in. And indeed, the origins of Hamas come from Israeli support in the 1980s as a counterweight to the rise of Palestinian nationalist organizations fighting the occupation at that point. But as a lawyer, I want to make it very clear, the collective punishment that Israel has imposed upon Gaza, particularly in the last 16 to 17 years with the blockade, is a fundamental violation of international humanitarian law. Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention expressly forbids collective punishment with no exceptions. And now, with this total siege that's now been imposed of no food, no water, no electricity, no goods going into Gaza, that's been imposed since the weekend. This, again, is a violation of international humanitarian law. International humanitarian law forbids the use of starvation as a tool to punish civilians during a military action. It forbids the use of coercive tactics, such as banning or lessening the availability of food, water, electricity, and any other goods needed for survival in a civilian population during the course of war. This has been cited on a number of occasions during the prior wars on Gaza, beginning in 2008, where purported war crimes were documented by successive human rights tribunals set up by the United Nations Human Rights Council. And they have, on 2008, 2009, 2014, 2018, 2019, to cite just three of the major reports, they all cited the disturbing nature in which Israel was violating international law in its attacks on Gaza. And to give you one example, in 2014, there was a 50-day assault on Gaza, which left in the end 2,300 Palestinians dead in Gaza, 1,500 of whom, about two-thirds, were civilians. And the report that came out afterwards noted the, quote, the impunity that prevails across the board for violations of international humanitarian and human rights law allegedly committed by Israeli forces. Israel must break with its recent lamentable track record in holding wrongdoers accountable. So revenge is something that's not permitted in international law. Israel has been dealt a deadly blow by the loss of, it appears to be, around 1,200 Israelis, many of whom are civilians. But revenge is not the answer. And as we've seen from these repeated escalation of assaults over the last 15 years, there is no military solution to this. The only solution is politics, diplomacy, under the framework of international law, to bring to an end the justified grievances of the Palestinians under occupation and to allow for a free Palestine.
Where do you come down, Michael Wink, on the use of language descriptors of Hamas? Is Hamas a terrorist organization? Are they terrorists? Trudeau just said, quote, "They aren't freedom fighters, they are terrorists, and no one in Canada should be supporting them, much less celebrating them." And Joe Biden has just announced that Hamas, they are the new ISIS. But what sense do you make of who Hamas is and what they are, what they represent?
Sure. What they represent would be a strain not only of Palestinian, but they are reflective of a broader, Arab political mobilization that rose in the 1970s and the 1980s, and there were antecedents before, which saw the failure of secular Arab groups and their inability to be able to either effectively achieve liberation during the anti-colonial periods in the 50s and 60s, or wound up seeing these secular organizations rule in a corrupt and inefficient manner. They grew up generally as pious organizations built around, obviously, religious political ideology based on the Quran, and were able to articulate a yearning that many Arabs, and in our case, Palestinians, would have had for an effective resistance movement that would address those forces that were afflicting them. What Hamas has evolved into, obviously, is the widespread and promiscuous use of terror tactics which target individuals and have left it utterly isolated in the international community. I think there was a period when it could have been said that Hamas, notwithstanding some of its appalling record, should have been recognized as a legitimate political force and found ways of at least bringing in those who weren't committed to using not armed struggle, but using terror tactics into a political negotiation process that would have helped to resolve and build a compassionate peace. That may be too late politically to be able to do that now. But your comment with respect to use of language, tells me that for all of these major UN commissions that have been initiated since 2008 and 2009, saying that Israel, its military and its political leadership, have likely committed war crimes in its various assaults on Gaza in particular, and as well through the building of Israeli settlements, which are war crimes under the Rome Statute and under Canadian legislation, why that attachment, that word war crime or war criminal, isn't attached to them, speaks, I think, of a rather skewed vision we have of where the law winds up applying. I never hear any Western leaders suggest anything more than Israel might be at fault in international law with respect to, the annexation of East Jerusalem or the building of settlements. But to use the word war crimes, which settlements are, which the annexation of occupied land is, and the use of indiscriminate military force, also is, I guess, a language we have to begin to cultivate to be able to say that there's fault on all sides. And my mission as a special rapporteur was to point out these serious violations of international law by Israel, but also by Hamas, and to say that the path to a compassionate peace is through the use, the sturdy guardrails of international law and human rights. West, Europe, North America, you wind up discarding or putting aside international law. A, you ensure that there's not going to be a just and lasting peace in the Middle East, but two, you wind up exposing or risking the accusations of hypocrisy by your use of international law when it comes to Ukraine and to the occupation of Crimea by Russia, but don't apply the very same standards to Israel and its occupation of Palestinian territory.
Where do you see this going, Michael Link? What do you think Israel's ultimate aims are? What's its goal? I've been hearing talk about Israel possibly wanting to actually drive out the people of Gaza, totally demolish, devastate Gaza, and then drive people out to wherever, across the border into Egypt, if you can imagine such a thing. Empty Gaza out and reoccupied physically. So where do you see this going?
Well, look, there's two ways in which this can go, David. First, that the coming assault on Gaza will be focused only on Gaza. We know from 2014, with the same prime minister in power, that there was a 50-day war on Gaza, which led to, as I said, 2,300 Palestinians being killed. Given the ferocity of the Hamas attack, largely on Israeli civilians, one may think that the strategic goal now of Israel is not simply more, to use their awful euphemism, cutting of the grass or mowing the grass, but to actually decapitate Hamas completely. And that would require, you know, probably the reoccupation of Gaza. And then the question is, you enter the store and break the glass, you own it. What does Israel then do with Gaza? Because you can be sure that the Palestinian Authority would not be interested in wanting to come into Gaza and rule it behind Israeli bayonets. So that's one possibility. The other is a wider conflict that might happen if there is a sustained uprising as well in the West Bank. If suddenly things become very hot in the border between Lebanon and Israel, we already have seen some skirmishes with soldiers killed on both sides between Hezbollah and the Israeli army. Hezbollah, as we know, is exceptionally well-armed with hundreds and maybe thousands of missiles stored in southern Lebanon that could easily penetrate into Israel. And there has always been a strategic desire among the Israeli military and Israeli political leadership to want to be able to tackle the growing nuclear capabilities of Iran. If there's enough intelligence relationships that are put out in public between Iran and what Hezbollah is doing or what Hamas is doing, one can imagine a situation where Israel might be tempted to take on Iran as well. This could also mean the expulsion of some Palestinians. I think the odds are low with respect to all this, but one always knows that it's easy to start a war. It's very hard to end a war on the terms that you want it. So these types of conflicts, particularly in the Middle East, have the potential for flying out of control with consequences that nobody foresaw at the very beginning.
What do you think the possibilities are of suddenly positive transformative change, ironically or paradoxically, because of Israel, you know, overstepping, crossing a red line, saying things like they're Yoav Gallant, their defense minister, referring to Palestinians as human animals, and all this talk about totally devastating Gaza and committing acts that are just so obviously transgressions of international law, mass casualties, that suddenly a solution is crystallized, not a whole regional conflagration, but the opposite of that. Do you see any prospects for such a positive thing to unfold?
Sure, David. Look, I'm an eternal optimist, and I think part of my optimism comes from being a lawyer, and it comes from believing in the sanctity of international law and in a rules-based framework and in the primacy of human rights. I believe that with educating, and educating again about the importance of respecting the rule of law in any conflict, it can be solved, and resolutions consistent with the rights of people and with equality can be found. But in this case, I must say, I feel quite pessimistic. I don't see any happy ending to this, and I don't see the ability for a genuine Palestinian self-determination emerging anytime in the future. The way in which, particularly the United States, has said on reserve.